film. There's rumors of a presidential apology to the victims and the and the families of the victims in the next State of the Union address, but there's already, which is in August, but there's already a backlash. We already have paramilitary groups calling him a communist, calling him a traitor, talking about impeachment proceedings. So there's, we don't know whether he's seen the film. He received the copy of his of the film though from his from a relative of his in his mother's living room, and we have a photograph of him holding the film in his mother's living room.
How many people were killed in 1965, 66, 67 in Indonesia by the Indonesian military and paramilitaries?
Almost certainly more than a million, perhaps up to three.
Oscar-nominated filmmaker Joshua Oppenheimer, director of The Look of Silence, which has just been released around the United States. October 1st marks the 50th anniversary of the beginning of the 1965 genocide in Indonesia. Participant media and human rights groups are circulating petitions calling for the United States to declassify and release its CIA, its military, its government, its corporate records about the killings in Indonesia and to acknowledge the U.S. role in the genocide. That does it for our broadcast. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Laura Gottesdiener, Dina Guzder, Amy Littlefield, Nermeen Sheikh, Sam Alkoff, Robbie Caron, Steve Martinez. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
KBOO is a proud sponsor of the Challenging Corporate Rule and Creating Democracy event with David Cobb, Sunday, August 9th, 7 to 9 p.m., doors at 6:30 p.m. at the First Unitarian Church, B102, at Southwest 12th and Salmon Street, Portland, Oregon, sponsored by the Alliance for Democracy, Move to Amend Portland, Economic Justice Action Group of the First Unitarian Church, the Pachamama Alliance, and KBOO. Move to Amend spokesperson David Cobb is coming to Portland, and he's going to talk to you to join the growing effort to abolish the doctrines of corporate constitutional rights and money as speech. And doors will open at 6:30 p.m.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Aurora Colony Vineyards 2015 Jazz Festival, August 9th, with doors opening at 2 p.m. and performances from 3 to 9 p.m. The Aurora Colony Vineyards is located at 21338 Oak Lane Northeast in Aurora, Oregon. Performers include Tony Lincoln, the Ron Steen Band, Picante Latin Jazz, Tom Grant, and many more. Again, that's the Aurora Colony Vineyards Jazz Festival, August 9th, from 2 to 9 p.m. More information about directions and ticket prices can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events. Ooh, what a little moonlight can do.
The time is 5:02, and you're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. Coming up next at 6, or at 5, is the evening news, followed at 6 by Labor Radio, and at 6:30, Prison Pipeline, and at 7, the River Signal. So stay tuned.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, professor of psychology justifies using questionable research to justify police shootings.
Southern Oregon forest fire spreads to 23 square miles over the weekend.
Trans-Pacific Partnership trade negotiations have slowed due to disagreements amongst the 12 involved nations.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, August 3rd, 2015. I'm Rosalind Scott.
And I'm Ken Jones. Trade negotiators failed to reach a final agreement on trade talks, known as the Trans-Pacific Partnership, or TPP. The talks ended on Friday in Maui, but representatives from the various countries vowed to continue with negotiations later this month, stating significant progress had been made. The TPP trade talks include the United States and 11 other Pacific Rim countries that represent more than 40% of world GDP. Earlier this year, the Obama administration won fast-track approval from the U.S. Congress, which prohibits amendments and forces an up-or-down vote with little debate. Under fast-track rules, more than 4 months from the end of negotiations to an actual vote in Congress is required. If an agreement is not reached this month, the final fast-track vote would occur during the U.S. presidential primary election season, complicating its passage. We'll have a full report on the TPP talks later this hour at 5:45, so stay tuned for that.
According to an article in Sunday's New York Times, Dr. William Lewinsky is a key figure in acquitting police officers in many cases where unarmed citizens are shot. Lewinsky is considered an expert witness in cases where he has successfully defended officers even when video footage shows the officer at fault. Lewinsky teaches a shoot-first policy, emphasizing the officer's concern with their own safety over concern for the safety of the citizen, often stopped for a mundane traffic stop. In one case, he helped acquit an officer who ordered an unarmed motorist to take his hand out of his pocket and then shot him when he complied, saying he thought the man had a gun. Lewinsky's alleged psychological studies say that police are justified in shooting with little provocation. For testifying, Dr. Lewinsky bills his time at nearly $1,000 per hour. Dr. William Lewinsky obtained his Ph.D. in 1988 from an alternative Cincinnati school, the Union for Experimenting Colleges and Universities. Students in this program are allowed to design their own curriculum. Lewinsky designed his own program and named it Police Psychology, which is a specialty not available anywhere else. Rather than publish his studies and findings in scientific journals, in 1999 Lewinsky chose to publish in a magazine popular with police officers called The Police Marksman. Had he published in a scientific journal, he would have been subjected to peer review process. His work has received much criticism from psychologists, citizens group, and an editor of the American Journal of Psychology who says his study is invalid and unreliable. Lewinsky has seminars and has trained tens of thousands of officers. He has testified in or consulted in nearly 200 cases in the last decade. Dr. Lewinsky's testimony has helped justify countless shootings in the United States, even when officers shoot an unarmed person or shoot a motorist in the back, or when a video or forensic evidence contradicts a police officer's story. When an officer is acquitted, very often it saves a city a substantial amount of money in payments for wrongful death. Meanwhile, the Police Executive Research Forum has called for more restraint from police and slower, better decision-making. Chuck Wexler, the director of the Police Executive Research Forum, says that even though most police chiefs from major cities are members of his organization, many did not realize that some of their officers had private sessions from businesses such as Lewinsky's Force Science Institute. Civil rights lawyers say that even if police policies change, most jurors want to believe the police officers. Lewinsky's testimony tells them that they can, in spite of evidence to the contrary. KBOO's Ethan Martin spoke earlier today with Portland Cop Watch's Dan Hadelman about Lewinsky.
I'm Dan Hadelman with Portland Cop Watch.
Okay. We wanted to talk about Professor William J. Lewinsky, who founded the Force Institute. If you could maybe explain who William J. Lewinsky is to us, that'd be great.
I believe the name of his organization is the Force Science Institute, and it grew out of his original group, which was called the Force Science Research Center. And his initial findings were based on non-scientific data, where they compared how fast it took for a person to try to shoot a police officer and turn around and run away, and how fast the officer could respond by shooting, and the person ended up getting shot in the back. So they were saying that, officers' bullets are slower than the criminals, so we always called that the Superman theory. But in essence, that finding is the basis of everything else that he's done, and everything else that he's done has been to find excuses for why police officers are justified, particularly when they use deadly force. He did this quasi-scientific study, and published it in a police journal, and then he got very famous and became an expert witness, and of course he testified at a famous hearing here in Portland 11 years ago. And yet, what they asked him in the article is, well, why didn't you get it peer-reviewed and put it into a scientific journal? And he said, oh, well, if I had to go back in time and do it, I would do it that way. So my question would be, well, why not just do the same experiment using scientific methods and then publish it in a scientific journal, right? There's nothing stopping him from doing that, except that he knows that he's not going to be able to get the answers that he wants.
Yeah, according to that last that New York Times article that went out on Sunday, Lewinsky he's testified at nearly like 200 police misconduct trials as an expert witness, and supposedly, literally, he never budges on his position that whatever the police officer did in the situation, he or she was in the right, whether it was shooting an unarmed person, shooting someone in the back, or even if the officer's testimony directly contradicts video evidence and witness testimony, his stand in court has always backed up that the officer was doing the appropriate thing in the situation. What is your response to this?
Well, I think it's, you know, practically criminal that a person like that can be used by police departments and cities who are trying to, you know, protect their bottom line. They don't want to get sued. They don't want their officers to be found out of policy. And you know, he's making money off of it while people are losing their loved ones and, you know, the officers are getting away with murder. So I think that it's very alarming, and I'm very glad. And we've been writing about this guy for almost 20 years now, since he first showed up on the scene. And one of the big questions we have as a group is, why was he allowed to testify? What he did here was he testified before the grand jury in the case of Jahar Perez, who was pulled over in North Portland because they didn't like the way his car looked in the neighborhood. And when he was reaching for his cell phone, they thought he was going for his gun, and they killed him. And, the police officers. And Lewinsky testified at the grand jury. And the grand jury is supposed to be just a place where the prosecuting attorney presents evidence and says, do you think a crime might have been committed? But instead he brought in this guy, this expert, to say, oh, well, you know, if the officer waited to see the gun, then he would be dead. And they found no wrongdoing.
Yeah, it seems like there's an obvious conflict of interest there. I mean, he's trained tens of thousands of officers to kind of think differently about police shootings that appear excessive or improper. He's been published regularly in popular police culture magazines. He's paid $1,000 an hour for his expert testimonies during many of these police misconduct trials. And clearly he has a monetary interest in his research.
Yep.
And so, and because he's regularly employed by government bodies that use his research to justify and defend the police shootings. So it's almost like his research is this tool for the government to justify their actions.
Well, I think that's exactly what the New York Times article was saying. I mean, and that's why I'm saying I think it's criminal. It's just not, that's, you know, what we need is the truth. We don't need somebody whose main goal is always to say the officer's right no matter what happened. That doesn't help anybody, except of course the officers and Dr. Lewinsky and his outfit to get rich. So it's just I'm hoping that this helps expose him and that he will lose credibility and that he'll stop being used for this purpose. Now he can still do his seminars, and that's the thing that concerns us also, that the Force Science Institute conducts seminars all the time, and we know that officers from Portland have gone. I don't think he's ever been invited here per se, but I think they just go to these conferences or whatever where he or his people are training. Articles by Force Science Institute appear on the rap sheet, which is the police union here, police association's newsletter here in Portland, and they reprint stuff by them all the time so that they're influencing their members to think the way that Dr. Lewinsky thinks, which is, no matter what you did, you were in the right. One of his main things that he has put out pseudoscience on is that, because it's so traumatic when a police officer shoots somebody, you have to wait at least 48 hours before you interview them, which is, of course, part of the police union's contract here that the community has been trying to get that changed for years. And there's recently a paper by Samuel Walker, who's an expert on police oversight, saying that that is junk science and nobody should listen to it. And even without knowing any science, I think we in the community say, you're not going to wait 48 hours before you ask somebody who supposedly murdered another civilian, a civilian who murdered another civilian, what they did. Why would you wait 48 hours before you talk to a cop? Except to extend them a special courtesy.
That was Dan Handelman from Portland's Cop Watch, and this is Ethan Martin with KBOO News.
Deaths attributed to police actions jumped last month to 118, making July the deadliest month of the year so far. The increase broke a three-month trend of decreasing police-caused deaths. Of the 118 people killed in July, at least 20 were unarmed. 106 were shot, one died from being tasered, one was run over by police vehicles, and eight died while in police custody.
A forest fire in Douglas County, southern Oregon, has grown to more than 23 square miles over the weekend. 35 families are currently unable to return to their homes, while another 100 families are prepared to leave their land if directed. The fire, which began on last Thursday, threatens more than 250 structures and has demanded the help of over 1,000 people to fight it. Light rain on Sunday aided firefighters, and fire team spokesman Dave Wells said they are not expecting explosive growth, although the fire is still only 3% contained.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth report on the Trans-Pacific Partnership. This will be followed by Labor Radio, Working Class News produced for and by members of the working class, at 6. At 6:30, it's Prison Pipeline. On tonight's show, Ruth Kovach interviews Debbie Parkins, whose brother Steve was released from prison 2 years ago this month. Steve served 8 years as a convicted sex offender. At 7, it's the River Signal, live from a boat on the Mississippi. Tomorrow's weather is sunny with highs of 81 and lows of 55. Today in history, in 1914, Germany declared war on France, beginning tensions between two of World War I's central participants. Also in 1977, the Tandy Corporation introduced the TRS-80, one of the world's first mass-produced personal computers. The quote of the day is, "The strategic adversary is fascism. The fascism in us all, in our heads and in our everyday behavior, the fascism that causes us to love power, to desire the very thing that dominates and exploits us." Michel Foucault.
Today, President Obama announced new regulations on carbon dioxide emissions, calling it a moral obligation and the single most important step ever taken in America to fight climate change. The 32% reduction on carbon dioxide emissions is the strictest reduction ever issued and also gives states 2 additional years to comply. Immediately, some Republican governors said that they will not comply, and opponents immediately said they will sue the government. While making the announcement, Obama was joined in the East Room of the White House by parents of children with asthma due to the pollution. The projected cost of limiting the emissions will be over $8 billion annually by the year 2030. KBOO's Ryan Stroyer recorded audio at an event held today by Environment Oregon, where Oregon Representative Earl Blumenauer, as well as several other specialists, spoke on the federal government's new regulations.
I am pleased that we have finally have the release of the plan. It shows a lot of hard work, compromise, refinement, giving path to each state to be able to meet their responsibilities, but meet the responsibilities nonetheless. The United States historically has been the greatest emitter of carbon pollution, only recently being rivaled by China. And on a per capita basis, we're far ahead. This is an opportunity for us to dive down on the major source of carbon pollution, these 1,000 coal power plants, dealing with stronger standards that candidly are long overdue. This is going to result in a long-term improvement in terms of not just the dealing with carbon pollution and climate. It's going to have powerful impacts on human health because there are lots of other toxic substances that are released from these 1,000 power plants. There will be, in the long term, there will be reduced energy costs for households. I think this is important step, but make no mistake, what starts today with the formal release is going to be a very vigorous campaign of disinformation, attack by those who support the status quo, and it's going to be important to try and clarify what we're going to do and how we're going to do it. I am pleased that our state and my community have already a significant head start. We know that we can do this, and most of the people I represent know that it's important that we do so.
The Clean Power Plan, you know, is building on an existing momentum that already operating in our economy and in our energy sector. We are moving out of coal progressively and not at a slow pace. We are moving to gas, to renewables, and to energy efficiency, and there's a real open question that still has to be explored there. You know, how much gas, how much renewables, how much efficiency, but the overall carbon direction is pretty clear. The U.S. peaked on carbon emissions in about 2007 and has been edging downhill pretty steadily ever since. Oregon actually peaked almost a decade earlier in 1999, and we have been working our way down. We are actually almost back to our greenhouse gas, the greenhouse gas emissions that we produced back in 1990. The Clean Power Plan has to be seen in combination with the auto fuel economy standards and truck fuel economy standards that the administration adopted earlier. Overall, between the power plant and the vehicle fuel economy standards, the country's aiming at something like a third lower greenhouse gas emissions by 2030 than we would otherwise have expected. So it's a very substantial drop in our emissions, and as the president said today, it gives us, you know, leverage in negotiating global reductions as well. What does it mean for Oregon? Well, obviously, as we said before, the Clean Power Plan builds on both Oregon's strengths and, you know, and the head start that Oregon already has in reducing greenhouse gas emissions starting back, you know, 15 years ago. Oregon is going to, appears like Oregon's going to have a less stringent target in the final rule than it was proposed to have in the draft rule, a substantially less stringent target depending on some of the contextual analyses that and calculations that EPA did. We were looking at, on a rate base, about a 48% reduction from 2012 by 2030. Looks more like about a 20% reduction from 2012 to 2030 based on the postings that EPA just put up. And we already were going to have a substantial head start on making our goal with the commitment to close down Boardman coal operations, with our energy efficiency, with the renewables that are being delivered by our renewable portfolio standards. So hard to say whether we're already in compliance or not, but we have certainly have a substantial head start toward the 2030 compliance for 2020 even hit.
That was audio from an event held today by Environment Oregon on the federal government's new regulations on coal plants.
A Montana Public Utilities Commission hearing on the Keystone XL pipeline entered its second week today. The hearing is expected to continue until Friday, and most observers of the Montana Commission say they are likely to allow the permits required for the pipeline construction through Montana. Tribal members and their lawyers questioned the representatives from TransCanada, but lawyers for the Pipeline Corporation frequently prevented the company representatives from answering questions. Here's an excerpt from today.
The sense I'm getting from your testimony is that largely it's based on a review of the PHMSA regulations. Is that true?
Yes, sir. And the submitted final amendment and changes, okay. Table of changes.
Are you aware of a lawsuit that is being filed by the National Wildlife Federation against PHMSA for apparently PHMSA's requirement to adequately put regulations in place concerning pipelines and pipeline spills over the last decade?
I saw it.
Objection assumes facts, not in evidence.
I'm going to
ask if he's aware. I just ask if he's aware of it. I didn't ask if he had any details. I just ask if he's aware of it.
There hasn't been any indication that any such lawsuit exists.
I'm just asking if he's aware of it.
Okay.
Either he is or he isn't.
I'll overrule and let him answer that.
I saw a Google headline mentioning something, but I did not read the article.
Okay. Thank you. I have no further questions.
One of the observers of the Public Utility Commission hearing reported that commissioners were asleep during key portions of the testimony. On Monday, a judge in London sentenced former Citibank and UBS trader Tom Hayes to 14 years in prison. While many of the world's leading banks have been fined for indiscretions, Hayes is the first person tried and convicted on charges of conspiring to manipulate a global interest rate, known as the London Interbank Offered Rate, or LIBOR. Hayes claimed he was merely following an industry-wide practice and described the breaking market as the Wild West, a place with no rules and where lavish entertainment was the norm. In September, six other London traders from three other financial institutions will also be tried on charges related to the manipulation of the London Interbank Offered Rate.
And now, the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center at www.imemc.org for Monday, August 3rd, 2015. Israeli soldiers injure a Palestinian youth and force another to drink gasoline. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. A Palestinian youth was injured on Monday at midday by Israeli soldiers' gunfire who are stationed at the Za'atara checkpoint in northern West Bank. The teen was standing in line with dozens of other Palestinians when he asked to use the bathroom. The Israeli soldiers claimed that the young man then attempted to run away. Soldiers shot him in the legs, causing moderate injuries. The military has closed the checkpoint and did not allow anyone to pass for hours. The Za'atara checkpoint connects the central West Bank to northern part of the West Bank, and its closure creates a chokehold for Palestinians trying to get to school, work, or hospitals. Also on Monday, a Palestinian youth was injured in the southern West Bank city of Hebron when soldiers forced him to drink gasoline after beating him up. According to witnesses, soldiers handcuffed Majdi Al-Muhtasib, 21, kidnapped and dragged him to a Turba neighborhood in Tal Armeida, threw him to the ground and started beating and kicking him for no reason whatsoever. The soldiers asked then if he wanted water, and when he said yes, one of them pretended to be helping him to drink water. When Majdi realized that it was gasoline and not water, the soldiers forced him to drink out of it. After the soldiers let him go, the youth's father took him to Alia Hospital in Hebron, where he suffered from severe pains and underwent medical tests. Early on Monday at dawn, Israeli forces invaded Beit Umar town near Hebron and kidnapped two Palestinian teenagers. On Sunday, a Palestinian man, Imad Abu Sharikh, was seriously injured when he was brutally attacked by three Israelis while returning from Al-Fajr prayers at Al-Kabir Mosque in Lod City. Abu Sharikh, who lives in the city, explained that three Israeli extremists were waiting for him at the entrance of his residence, where they attacked him with sticks and sharp tools. He called the Israeli police, but they did not come. He was moved to hospital with injuries to his head. And that's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was the Monday, August 3rd, 2015 news roundup from the Occupied Palestinian Territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by George Shmawi, Amni, Ghassan Bannoura.
Violence from the Mexican Gulf Coast state of Veracruz, described as one of that country's deadliest areas, spread to Mexico City last week when photojournalist Ruben Espinosa was found murdered. Espinosa became the 13th journalist from that state, where the violence has been particularly hard on media workers, murdered during Governor Javier Duarte's administration. Three other reporters have disappeared mysteriously. Espinosa's body was found in an apartment in a normally quiet area of Mexico City Friday night, along with those of four women, all of them murdered, execution style, with gunshots to the head. Espinosa had fled the Veracruz capital, Jalapa, in June to seek what he hoped would be safety in Mexico City, telling friends he was running in fear of men who were watching him in his home. The journalist routinely covered social movements, including student activism at the local state university. This included a recent story about student activist who faced a targeted machete attack. He began to be watched around the same time that his story was published. Among the four women victims were Nadia Vera, an anthropologist and student activist who had also fled Jalapa after experiencing incidents such as a break-in at her former apartment, which she believed to be politically motivated. Last November, Vera had told a television interviewer that the rate of student disappearances began to increase greatly in 2010, with Duarte assuming the office of governor. Of the other three women found dead, only one, an 18-year-old, has been identified. For more information, Shannon Young has this report from Mexico City.
Photojournalist Ruben Espinosa was found dead in a Mexico City apartment Friday night. But he wasn't alone. Four other people, all women, were also murdered in the same way, with execution-style gunshots to the head. Espinosa had moved to Mexico City in June, fleeing a climate of fear and intimidation in the Gulf Coast state of Veracruz, by far Mexico's deadliest region for media workers. In an interview last month on Rompeviento TV, Espinosa explained that he decided to leave Jalapa, the capital city of Veracruz, after men in plain clothes made it clear that they were watching him outside of his home. The conspicuous surveillance coincided with a particularly brutal machete attack targeting student activists at the state university, a story Espinosa documented as a reporter who routinely covered social movements.
The harassment against the press in Veracruz is an ongoing thing, and it's an everyday thing.
Ricardo González is with the Mexico Office of Article 19, an international press freedom and transparency organization. He says this particular case marks a watershed moment.
Mexico City has been well known among the journalist community and human rights defenders community as a safe haven. And all of a sudden, this is the first case in which a person that has fled the violence from different regions from Mexico, seeking some sort of security in Mexico City, they were actually attacked in the city.
But Espinosa wasn't the only exile from Veracruz murdered in Mexico City Friday. Nadia Vera, an anthropologist and student activist, was also among the victims. She had fled Jalapa due to incidents that made her fear for her life, including a break-in at her former apartment, which she believed was politically motivated.
Llevamos cuántos periodistas asesinados y no ha pasado nada.
After relocating to Mexico City, she remained outspoken about the situation in Veracruz, like in this interview with Rompeviento TV from last November.
nos empieza a preocupar mucho porque empieza a elevarse el índice de desapariciones a partir de 2000.
We started to get very worried when the rate of disappearances spiked in 2010 after Duarte took power as governor. The violence spread and we began to realize that we were the product they were after. I say product in the sense that as women, they'll grab you for sex trafficking and they'll recruit students to become hired killers. And those of us who are in the way are considered a problem, both by the government and the narcos. So we're trapped between two fronts and their use of repression through legal and illegal means.
18-year-old Yesenia Quiroz is the third victim identified from the multi-homicide. Two others remain unnamed at this time. Media reports indicate three of the women were roommates and a fourth was a housekeeper. In a weekend press conference, Mexico City Attorney General Rodolfo Rios Garza said all lines of investigation are open, including the motive of robbery. Rios Garza did not mention that at least two of the victims had left Veracruz due to fear. News of the multi-homicide triggered demonstrations by journalists and human rights activists in Mexico City, Oaxaca City, and in Jalapa. But Ricardo González of Article 19 says the scope of the crime has shaken people beyond the victims' professional and social circles.
The fact that five persons were found dead in a relatively calm and safe neighborhood in Mexico City is actually a shocking news for, you know, the common citizen. And now, added to the fact that they were, you know, facing threats from the government from Veracruz, that's also shocking because it's the first time that we see that kind of violence in Mexico City. People were under the assumption that Mexico City, despite of the many problems they have, it was actually a safe city. And now the reality is catching up with us.
Ruben Espinosa is the 13th journalist from Veracruz murdered during Governor Javier Duarte's administration. He's the second killed outside of Veracruz this year after the murder of Armando Saldaña in Cosolapa, Oaxaca in May. Three other journalists in the state are disappeared. It's now up to Mexico City authorities to either take into account the documented harassment targeting at least two of the victims as a line of investigation, or to continue with the established practice of chalking up the murders of journalists and activists to random acts of crime. Shannon Young, FSRN, Oaxaca.
Last week, a Japanese grand jury ruled three former TEPCO executives should face charges for failing to take proper precautions to prevent the nuclear meltdowns that occurred during the 2011 earthquake and tsunami. As of today, no charges have actually been filed. In other Fukushima news, TEPCO officials have released a report showing that ground subsidence threatens to topple the heavily damaged reactor buildings. The ground has subsided unevenly by up to 2.5 feet across the plant, causing the buildings to degrade more rapidly than expected. In addition, high radiation levels have caused the building to undergo rapid corrosion, further threatening the stability of the reactor buildings. The buildings are currently too radioactive to enter, much less repair or decommission. Authorities believe it may be more than 40 years before decommissioning can occur. Experts worry that even a minor earthquake could cause the reactor buildings to collapse, lending to an uncontrolled airborne release of highly radioactive isotopes.
The Obama administration has approved the use of defensive airstrikes against the Syrian government. The plan calls for U.S. airstrikes if Syrian troops are found to be attacking moderate U.S.-backed rebels who are fighting both the Syrian government and ISIS. The U.S. government to develop U.S. program to develop a moderate fighting force to drive back ISIS and fight the Syrian government has so far trained only 50 moderate rebels. In the past, the vast majority of U.S.-backed moderate rebels defected and joined ISIS, which now controls large parts of both Iraq and Syria. The move follows a U.S.-Turkey deal last month to allow U.S. fighter jets to use Turkish air bases in exchange for allowing Turkish forces to bomb Kurdish positions near the Iraq border. Critics argue the deal is more about consolidating Turkish President Erdogan's power before upcoming elections than actually fighting ISIS rebel forces. Currently, Kurdish forces are among the most successful at driving back ISIS forces. The Kurds won almost 15% of the general vote during the last elections in Turkey. Almost 25 million Kurds live in the Turkey, Iraq, and Syria region. Over the last year, Kurdish forces made large territorial gains in Syria along the Turkish border and are now ruling the area as an autonomous Kurdish region.
Investigators in Colombia's second largest city began work this week to exhume human remains from what is considered to be the world's largest mass grave in an urban area. Louis Reining reads for Jorge Luis Rocha in Medellin, Colombia.
A formal event Monday kicked off what is to be a five-month search in La Escombrera, a massive rubble dump located on a hillside overlooking Medellin. Discovering just how many bodies lie hidden under the tons of waste will be a job for forensic investigators. But the confession of a former paramilitary boss suggests at least 300 bodies were dumped there. Gustavo Andres Duque, the special investigator in charge of the exhumation, says the team is more likely to encounter remains like long bone fragments and teeth rather than intact skeletons. He adds that all forensic evidence will be DNA tested and kept in a special facility. Many of the victims believed to be buried in the rubble date back to a series of urban counterinsurgency operations carried out in 2002 by the government of then-president Álvaro Uribe. The largest of these was Operation Orion, a military-led effort targeting leftist militias and urban guerrillas in the sprawling working-class district known as La Comuna 13. Operation Orion lasted 5 days in October of 2002 and involved the use of armed helicopters, tanks, and more than 1,000 soldiers. The government said the operation resulted in 11 deaths, 200 wounded, and 243 arrests. But local residents have long told a different story. Father Javier Giraldo is a Catholic priest and human rights defender who has accompanied families of victims while documenting crimes committed against the civilian population during Operation Orion.
There were more than 500 arrests. They had to let most of them go within a month due to lack of evidence. The army would surround a block, people would come out of their homes terrified, and they'd grab all the men, especially the young men. They'd ask for their identification and confiscate them. Police investigators carried around blank forms, and they'd use the ID cards to fill them out. They pretended like they had arrest warrants. This was all in flagrant violation of the law.
But many young men picked up for questioning never returned.
Yo soy la madre de Carlos Emilio Torres Holguín, desaparecido el 29.
63-year-old Gloria Holguín is the mother of Carlos Emilio Torres Holguín, who vanished in November of 2002 after three men in plain clothes stopped by his girlfriend's house in the Comuna 13 and insisted he'd go with them to have a talk.
That conversation has yet to end because he still hasn't come back. And ever since then, I've searched for him everywhere. I've filed reports everywhere and hadn't had a response. My daughters still say they didn't just lose a brother, but lost a mother as well because I no longer did my housework. I spent more time in the streets than at home.
Not long after the mass disappearances began, rumors began circulating about the disposal of the bodies in the rubble dump. By then, La Escombrera was territory under the total control of the AUC, a hyper-violent right-wing paramilitary network. Government officials argued that it was too dangerous to attempt to carry out an investigation given the presence of armed groups. Yet even after the government reached a demobilization deal with the paramilitaries, La Escombrera remained in operation, with trucks dumping even more tons of rubble on top of the hidden victims. Gloria Holguín says this added insult to injury.
The government's response came very late. Everyone knew that bodies were brought here, buried here, and covered with rubble, and yet it was allowed to keep operating as a dump. If the response would have come 2 or 3 years after Operation Orion, the process of identification would be much easier.
Nearly 13 years after Operation Orion, mothers and other relatives of the disappeared anxiously await the results of the dig, with the hope of being able to finally bury their dead with dignity and begin the process of closure. For FSRN, I'm Louis Reining, reading for Jorge Luis Rocha in Medellin, Colombia.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Rosalind Scott, Ken Jones, Ryan Stroyer, and Martin Dodge. Our producer is Ethan Martin, and our engineer is Danielle Parks. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Jenka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews or look for us on Twitter at KBOO News. If you'd like to call your elected representatives about any issue you've heard on the news tonight, here are the phone numbers, so get a pen or something to write with. The local number for Senator Ron Wyden is 503-326-7525. The number for Senator Jeff Merkley is 503-326-3386. Oregon Governor Kate Brown's number is 503-378-3111. Portland Mayor Charlie Hales can be reached at 503-823-4120. You are listening to KBOO, Portland, 90.7 FM, K282BH, Philomath, 104.3 FM, and K220HR, Hood River, 91.9 FM. I'm Rosalind Scott.
And I'm Ken Jones. Coming up on Tuesday morning on KBOO. At 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, Abe Proctor and Joe Uris host the surprisingly named Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show. At 9, on Alternative Radio, award-winning journalist and author Chris Hedges speaks on moral imperatives. At 10, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, hear Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. At 11, D. May Roberts hosts Stage and Studio, a weekly live show featuring the best of performing, literary, and media arts in Portland and beyond. At 11:30, Art Focus is off today. Instead, we'll hear an interview with T. Geronimo Johnson, author of the novel Welcome to Braggsville, about Berkeley students who try to disrupt a Civil War reenactment. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. You're not a current member? Well, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today. Now stay tuned for an in-depth report on the Trans-Pacific Partnership. I talk with Adam Weissman,